Counsel for our final case can approach. Our final oral case, I should say. I'll call the matter. It's A230992 Johnson versus State of Minnesota. Counsel, as you're getting seated, I'll make a few announcements. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and the appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. These matters are being recorded. That's the only recording that's permitted today. And please state your name and identify your client before you begin speaking. And counsel, as soon as you get settled, we are ready for you whenever you are ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Stephen Furch on behalf of appellant, and with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. In sum, your honors, the case presented at trial and the evidence presented at trial was insufficient to sustain a conviction on both counts, domestic assault and disorderly conduct, brawling or fighting. Now, in this case, there are discussions to be had about do we apply direct or circumstantial evidence as the standard of review, and what is the definition of brawling or fighting under the disorderly conduct statute. But before we get there, your honors, I believe that this case turns on whether the state had to prove first whether Mr. Johnson threw the phone at RR. So the question is whether it's enough for them to prove he simply threw the phone or whether he had to throw the phone at her or intend.
Doesn't the Fleck case resolve that issue for us? I mean, aren't we required to apply the analysis there of the Supreme Court that this is a assault harm is a general intent offense?
Yes, Your Honor. Assault harm is absolutely a general intent offense, and that's been reiterated throughout this court and the Supreme Court's case law. But to make my point, I would offer, I guess, a hypothetical for the court. And what I'm getting at is this court needs to be very careful not to interpret domestic assault harm as a public welfare or a strict liability offense or even an offense that requires a lesser mens rea, such as recklessness, for example. So, Your Honor, let's say I'm walking down the street. And I'm walking down the street, I'm listening to AirPods, I'm listening to the Vikings-Packers game. This is the example I came up with. There's this Packer fan that's next to me, and they're cheering when the Packers do something good. They're gloating or mocking me when the Vikings do something bad. Sure enough, as the Vikings are wont to do, as I'm walking around listening to the game, and I kind of have an idea this Packer fan is next to me, I'm listening to the game, the Vikings lose the game at the end of the game on a last-second touchdown. I am in that moment, I am frustrated, I am exacerbated, I am upset. And in that moment, when they give up that touchdown, I flail my arms. And I say, come on, you know, what are we doing here? As I flail my arms, with no intent to flail my arms at someone who is standing next to me, I happen to hit this Packer fan. Now, under those circumstances, the question for this court is, did I have the general intent to hit that particular Packer fan? And what I would do is I would contrast that example with the example of same situation. I'm walking down the street listening to the game, and there's a Packer fan that walks up to me and mocks my Justin Jefferson jersey, for example. I motion my arm towards them, like, get away from me. As I motion my arm, intending to motion my arm at them, but not necessarily intending to cause any harm or to hurt them, I hit that particular Packer fan. Now, in the latter situation, I would have, one, a volitional act, and two, a guilty mind, which is required for most criminal offenses, except for criminal offenses that are public welfare offenses, such as open bottle in a motor vehicle, or bringing a gun through airport security. Those have been considered to be strict liability offenses.
Well, what the problem I have is that you are maintaining that your client had his back to the victim. But we have RR testifying that he was in the process of turning. So that is not proving that his back was towards her. That's a leap that you're asking us to adopt, isn't it?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think at best
the process of turning is not evidence that his back was to her.
I think the testimony, Your Honor, at trial.
I want the jury to believe, but the jury did hear from her that he was in the process of turning.
They did, but the jury also heard from her that she did not see him actually throw the phone. And if he's in the process of turning, that doesn't mean that he's looking at her, that he's aiming at her necessarily. And regardless whether that was RR's testimony at trial, I don't think it's dispositive, and I don't think it rises to the level of direct evidence as we get into this direct versus circumstantial evidence discussion. Your Honor, if...
I'm getting towards a sufficiency of the evidence argument because that would be something the state had proven or demonstrated that was her testimony.
Yes, Your Honor, and the state also proved that she did not see him throw the phone. So the action of actually throwing the phone, there is no evidence. No one saw that. There is no direct evidence of what actually happened when he threw the phone. True, maybe he's going like this as I kind of gesture a little turning motion to throw the phone. But, Your Honor, I don't think that rises to the level of direct evidence. And Your Honor touched on the sufficiency of the evidence. I think before we get even there, something we need to resolve is this a direct or is this a circumstantial evidence case? And as this court knows, courts, appellate courts, Supreme Court has said that evidence of intent very rarely is proven by direct evidence. There are a few examples that we cited in our brief where there was direct evidence of intent, and that direct evidence constituted statements made by the defendant, where the defendant was saying things such as, I'm going to beat you bloody, et cetera.
How is it a reasonable inference from the circumstances prove that he did not intend to strike her with the phone? I mean, when you look at all of the circumstances proved.
Yes, Your Honor.
That the fight was escalating, he had been throwing stuff before, the pictures, which are also a circumstance proved, where the phone hit her square in the face and left a bloody mark and a bruise right in the middle of her face. I mean, that's some pretty good aim. That he saw her she saw him turning as that phone was hitting her, and then the circumstances after, where she retreats to the bathroom, she's calling 911, he's telling her, don't do it, it'll ruin my life, et cetera. So why aren't all of those circumstances proved consistent with only one reasonable inference?
I believe if we look at the totality of the circumstances that were proved, even the totality of the circumstances offered by the state, we have evidence first from RR that she did not see him throw the phone. We have evidence. He apologized profusely after, which I would say is consistent with someone who did not intend to hit her in the face. And that's a circumstance that was proved at trial by the state.
But this whole discussion is sort of based on an assumption that specific intent is required, and it's not required. And general intent would mean, did he intend to make the act, make the movement that resulted in the phone being tossed in the air, right? I mean, do you agree with me that that's what general intent would require?
I would respectfully add that general intent in this particular circumstance requires more than him simply throwing the phone. If he throws the phone without any intent for it to be thrown in her direction, he doesn't have requisite knowledge of the facts that require that he needs to have to make his conduct illegal. And that's where I get into this distinction between a strict liability offense and a strict liability offense, maybe a recklessness standard. I mean, as the court knows, a strict liability.
Can I just clarify? Are you saying that in addition to that, the general intent includes the must throw the phone in her direction?
Yes, Your Honor.
So then, okay, let's assume that that's true. I'm not necessarily agreeing with you, but let's assume that that's true. Given where the phone was thrown and that it actually hit her, what is a reasonable inference other than it was thrown in her direction?
Simply that, consistent with his testimony, consistent with his behavior prior.
His testimony is not a circumstance proved, right?
Not by the state, correct, Your Honor. But if we look at, there was portions of the argument earlier where the defendant was throwing things that did not hit her. Presumably, he didn't intend to hit her with those objects. It stands to reason that later he also did not intend to hit her with the phone. I think we also look to the fact, as I mentioned, that she did not see it happen. We have the circumstance where Mr. Johnson, and this was proven by the state, disengaged himself from the argument multiple times, trying to resolve this particular argument peacefully. That conduct is completely inconsistent with the inference that he threw the phone in her direction. Additionally, I'd point to the fact that he apologized immediately after as showing that this was not someone who intended to do it. It's clear from the evidence,
I just have to take you back to my first question. How do we get to where you want us to go in light of State versus Fleck? How do we get there?
Your Honor, if the court looks at the Lampkin case, for example, 994 Northwest 2nd, 280, Minnesota Supreme Court, 2023, the court found, quote, that the state must prove that appellant's application of force to his partner was not done accidentally or involuntarily. If the court looks at the Kuhlman case, that's unpublished, A13-1120, the court found that the defendant's admission of throwing the pipe at her boyfriend was sufficient evidence to sustain a conviction for domestic assault. I am not aware of any case law where an individual, like my hypothetical, has no intention to direct their volitional conduct towards someone is enough to convict somebody of domestic assault.
So it's up to the reviewing court, then, it sounds like, to review the case in a sufficiency challenge to ensure that there's more than simple recklessness or accident.
That's exactly right, and that's what I'm offering. And that's the argument that, to try to address your point the best I can, the general intent requires more than just negligence or just recklessness. The Minnesota Supreme Court in the Morrissey case, essentially found that a strict liability offense punishes negligence where a level of care is required. A strict liability offense punishes inaction where a duty is required. Here, to find that all he had to do was throw the phone somewhere would be to punish him for perhaps negligence and not giving enough care as to where RR was at the time he threw his phone, or recklessness. Maybe he had knowledge that she was somewhere in the area, and in throwing his phone, he acted in reckless disregard of whether he would cause her that bodily harm. But domestic assault harm, as a general intent offense, requires more. And that's why we are saying to the court that it is required that he intended to throw the phone at her. Now,
which
I would agree.
Like specific intent.
Specific intent, Your Honor, is to intend the specific harm that is done by the action. Here, he still needs to intend the action, and that action is throwing the phone at her. And Your Honor is exactly right to zero in on this particular point, because candidly, if the court finds that Mr. Johnson, or the state is only required to prove that Mr. Johnson intended to throw his phone, not necessarily throw it at her, I believe the convictions are appropriate as to both counts. I think the crux of this case, and that's why I led off with it in my argument, is whether the state is required to prove that he intended to throw the phone at her, or whether he is just intended to throw the phone.
Can I just turn your attention to the disorderly conduct count? Is it your position that some physical contact has to occur for liability to attach?
Yes, Your Honor.
And why is that the case when the definition, as it's stated in the briefing, of brawling means to noisily quarrel or fight? That's a disjunctive.
It's a very important question, Your Honor, and thank you for it. If the court looks at the disorderly conduct statute as a whole, If the court looks at the very subsections of subdivision one, the court will see that the disorderly conduct statute is largely penalizing public nuisance type offenses. And within that statute, you have brawling or fighting, which is subdivision one, parens one. You have subdivision one, parent two, which is essentially yelling fighter in a theater, you know, disturbing an assembly. And then you have subdivision one, parent three, which is loud or offensive conduct or language that would reasonably alarm or disturb others. In order to effectuate both subdivision one, parent one, and subdivision one, parent three, there needs to be a different definition between those two subdivisions.
Why? I mean, those charges are not mutually exclusive. You could be charged under several subsections for the same conduct, not convicted for the same conduct, but you could be charged.
That's correct, Your Honor, but what we must presume in statutory interpretation is that the legislature did not intend to make part of the same statute superfluous.
So what do we make of the definition of brawling as including noisily quarrel? Are we just supposed to discount that?
Your Honor, I found, if the court looks to the definition of brawl or fight, it hasn't been defined in Minnesota specifically. But if we look to other states, if we look to Wisconsin, if we look to Alaska, in both of those situations with a similar statute, the Supreme Courts of those states adopted a definition that required some element of physicality. If we don't have an element of physicality in subdivision 1, paren 1, it is the same as subdivision 1, paren 3. Why would the legislature make two subdivisions or subsections of the same statute encompass the same conduct? It produces absurd results.
All right, I'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I forgot to look at my time.
Right, thank you. Counsel, whenever you're ready.
And this is the clock, correct? I was looking for
it.
Thank you.
When it says 15, you know that's the place.
Perfect. May it please the court. My name is Joe Vantomi, and along with my co-counsel, we represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. We respectfully request that this court affirm both convictions against the appellant that the jury returned in this case. Turning first to the domestic assault conviction, and specifically, as outlined in the briefs, the intent issue, the intentionality of the act here. There was sufficient direct evidence presented to the jury, viewed in the light most favorable to that verdict of guilty, for the jury to have reasonably found the defendant committed an intentional act of domestic abuse, bodily harm.
What's the direct evidence of his intent?
Thank you, Your Honor, for that question, because that's literally the next thing I was going to say is the 911 recording that was published to the jury. The 911 recording that was published to the jury, the 911 operator asked specifically, did he act intentionally to harm you or was it unintentional? And the victim's response published to the jury was, yeah, he was angry. In that dialogue, the victim also stated, he tried to hit me in the mouth. Now, statements like, yes, he was angry and he tried to hit me in the mouth are acts of intention. When you try to do something, you're attempting to do it. That's direct evidence published to the jury. Listening to that evidence, a jury could have reasonably said that that's exactly what we need to hear when we decide, did somebody do something on purpose with an intention? Additionally, the body-worn camera.
Well, that might be direct evidence of her interpretation of his intent. Is it your position that someone else's perception can be direct evidence of the defendant's intent?
I think it has to be, Your Honor. I don't know what other proof we would have on an intentionality case short of a full confession. We have to look and say, what do the witnesses say?
Do you have any authority for that argument?
I think it's the instructions that the jury's going to get on how they weigh credibility of witnesses. Direct evidence in this case, the instructions to the jury was largely, direct evidence is going to be what someone says they saw. So a witness says, I saw this happen. Circumstantial evidence is, I saw mud, you know, footprints from a mud puddle leading away, so I can infer one step further that that person walked in mud.
But isn't that what she's doing? Isn't she inferring from his actions what his state of mind is? So is it her testimony circumstantial as to what his state of mind is and not direct evidence of his state of mind?
I think a couple things. Number one, I think it can be direct evidence, but even if we treat it as circumstantial evidence and go that extra step where we ask the question, what were the circumstances proved and what reasonable inferences can we draw, it meets the test either way, whether we apply a direct evidence standard or a circumstantial evidence standard. Additional evidence that we may look at is the defendant's statement on his body-worn camera to the officers when he's explaining and recounting what happens. He says, forgive me if it's not an exact quote, "I just got up frustrated and threw my phone." It doesn't sound like somebody saying they got up and it was just an accident. Now, we heard that later at testimony, but again, we discount that.
Is that direct evidence of his intent, what he said?
I think a jury could reasonably conclude that. Somebody saying, "I got up and it was an accident and I threw it," versus "I got up frustrated in the heat of an argument, a 10-minute scream fest, and threw my phone," I think a jury could have looked at that, and I think the jury did look at that and said, that's what people do when they're angry in a fight. They throw things. They hit people. So I think if we look at it, I would submit to the court there is direct evidence, but we can go down the circumstantial evidence path. And to be perfectly honest, I think the circumstantial evidence is probably more persuasive anyways, because we say what was proven. We look and we say the victim says she believes her perception, her opinion, was that it was an intentional act. It was an escalating argument. The victim testifies that the defendant, or the appellant, excuse me, was throwing things at her throughout the course of the argument before the final altercation. The defendant admitted on cross-examination that every single one of his other acts, that he didn't throw it forward, he didn't throw it at the cat, he didn't throw it on the ground, that he picked it up with certain hands and not others, all of those were intentional acts that he took. The defendant was yelling, swearing, slamming fists, dishes. The victim stating, "She's backing away. It's scary. I need to be able to make sure I can protect myself." We look at those were all proven to the jury. And then we look and say the phone hit her square in the face. Hit her absolutely in the face. We don't have to ask, well, what did he intend? Do we know he hit her in the face? As the court indicated, that's pretty good aim for somebody who's not intending to do something. And then we look and say, what else did the jury hear? Well, they heard the defendant's inconsistent statements about what he knew about where she was. He testified that he didn't know where she was. On the body-worn camera, he says she's right there in that doorway. The jury heard all of that.
So I just want to have some discussion with you. I'd like to know your view about some of the arguments that appellant's counsel made concerning, general intent and sort of the limitations that the reviewing court has to place around general intent to avoid convictions where, someone was merely reckless, someone was engaged in accidental physical behavior. Obviously, you agree that this is assault harm is a general intent crime. What is your view about some of the arguments that appellant's counsel made regarding, accidental conduct?
Your Honor, I think number one, the Fleck case governs the entire progeny of cases following that, the Lindahl case, that governs, that clarifies assault harm is in a general intent crime, which means we look at the conduct and say, did the person intentionally act? Was that act intentional? Not a volition, not an involuntary act, not a reflex, the so-called epileptic fit piece.
So if he intended to just throw his phone, regardless of his intent, as to the direction of the phone, that would be sufficient, in your view, for a domestic assault conviction, assault harm?
I think it would, but specific to these facts, I think counsel misclarifies it. He says I unintentionally threw it at her. Well, we know you hit her, and we know you acted intentionally based on the circumstances proved. That's what the whole point of general intent is. You can imagine from a policy perspective, the difference between general intent and specific intent. If somebody were, say, charged with a felony assault based on degree of harm, where you have to prove bodily harm, if we follow counsel's position on that, that it's actually a specific intent crime, then we look and we say, well, that person would always have an out against criminal liability to be able to say, I didn't just punch the person in the face and intend to break their orbital bone. I only intended to punch him, so therefore I'm not guilty because the state can't prove what I intended to do. And that's that whole point. Policy-wise, we look and say that's what we want. When we have general intent crimes where bodily harm occurs, we don't want someone to be able to get away from criminal liability by saying, I didn't actually intend to hit her in the phone, I meant to hit her in the forehead, or intended to throw it above her head. Harm happened, you acted intentionally, the courts, and actually, quite frankly, the statutes. The statutes define intentional act for harm or with intent to, which places it squarely in someone's mind because you do need to prove that they had to cause harm, a specific goal. So I think counsel's wrong on that. I think they're on these facts, it is a general intent crime. We need to prove a volitional intentional act and that bodily harm occurred for a very good policy reason. We don't want to quibble about that when someone has been harmed. As I wrote it out last night, I said something to the effect of, it's the legislature's policy on this is that it's much worse to get punched in the face than to get threatened. And that's why they don't have equivalent proof. It's proof beyond a reasonable doubt. We look at it from direct and circumstantial, but there are different things that are proven.
He raises the sufficiency of the evidence as it relates to disorderly conduct. So the standard jig was given that it just is engaging in brawling or fighting. I assume that everyone agreed to the standard jig. There wasn't any discussion then about the possible question as to what brawling or fighting was?
Yeah, correct, Your Honor. There was no discussion at the district court level. It was the court followed the standard jury instruction guides. A couple things to unpack with that on brawling or fighting and whether these facts, either direct evidence or circumstantial evidence, are sufficient to have convicted. When terms are not defined in statute, we use plain language.
That's my question. If they're not, I mean, there's so many terms are not defined. Do you think this is something that rises to a precedential nature, that there needs to be a determination by this court as to what that means?
Your Honor, I think it can go both ways as to whether we're creating new law. I don't believe we actually are, for the reasons I can get into shortly. I think the Minnesota courts always look to definitions and dictionaries and say, what's the common usage? I think that both parties agree we did that in this case. We looked at what are the definitions of these terms. I think the court has isolated brawling could be non-physical conflict. Fighting, sure, that's physical conflict. Or is disjunctive, non-physical, physical conflict. That's what's criminalized here. As far as whether we need a statement for precedent to say only physical fighting or non-physical fighting could go both ways, I would point to the facts of this case and say, let's talk more about what physical is. Because if we've got somebody who is screaming, swearing, name-calling, throwing things, breaking things, slamming things, to the point where somebody's backing up in fear, saying it's scary, ultimately gets hit in the face, I don't know that I agree that isn't physical. I think that is physical. That's causing harm and noise to somebody. That is physical. That's the definition of a fight. We could go the other way and say, if we want to keep them separate, say the assault harm is the hitting in the face, the brawling part, the loud, noisy quarrel, that's the yelling, shouting, throwing, hitting. I think we could go either way. So to answer your Honor's question, I don't know that we're actually creating new law. I think it's both.
Is that something that an appellate court should do, or is that something our legislative, our neighbors across the street should be determining?
I think the legislature should probably clarify if it's needed, but there's not a lot of case law on what these terms mean, but there is statutes, 645.08, canons of construction. We look and define common terms. Council picked Merriam-Webster. Let's go with Merriam-Webster. That's a dictionary we look at. Clearly, it's non-physical or physical harm that's criminalized here. Counsel mentions other states we should look to. And again, I don't think we need to do that, but if we do, let's talk about the Alaska case, Dawson v. State. He suggests that statute, that Supreme Court there, looked at a similar statute and said clearly force is required because they determined it is. But that statute, 11.61.110(5), that statute talks about fighting. And it uses other words like challenging to fight, clearly indicating physical fight is covered there. And again, a plain language dictionary definition of fighting, sure, that's a physical altercation. But they don't include brawl. So again, back to what did our legislature do? They said brawling or fighting. Minnesota said we want to criminalize conflicts that are so alarming by nature that people are disturbed, that it causes a breach of peace, whether physical or non-physical. Now, counsel, it's clear they want us to talk about offensive, noisy, boisterous, and absolutely, we could charge lots of things. We could have also said there's criminal damage to property if some of those items broken by the defendant were his spouse's or someone else's. We could have said, let's charge a fifth-degree assault instead of a domestic assault. Lots of things apply, but it doesn't mean that the facts here are insufficient to prove the charge of disorderly conduct, brawling, or fighting. The last piece, the part about knew or had reason to know. Counsel raises in their brief this discussion that the victim in this case cannot be the person who was alarmed, because that's a mutual combatant in this argument, in this quarrel, in this altercation. Well, the statute says by others, plural, other people. Now, how do we know that others were alarmed here? Well, from the transcript. If we look at the transcript, on page 55, the defendant admits, I was putting one of the young children to bed that night. Transcript 15, the victim says, during the course of this 10-minute scream fest, what are you doing? You're going to wake up the boys, putting him on notice. You're going to alarm somebody. You're going to disturb them. Same page, our older son woke up. Transcript 59, the defendant says, she told me I woke the boys up. He knows my conduct is going to be the type that people are going to be alarmed by, disturbed by, and what happens? One of the child, someone else, wakes up. They are disturbed from sleep, alarmed by what's going on. Daddy's mad, it's going to be fine. That's what her statement was. So is he alarmed? Has someone been alarmed by his conduct of brawling or fighting? A young child waking up in the middle of the night to someone yelling, swearing, slamming, breaking things? I can imagine nothing more alarming. We'd respectfully request that you affirm the convictions against the appellant in both charges. Thank you.
Anything else from the panel? Thank you very much. Counsel, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you, Your Honors. Again, I think the court's questions to Mr. Vantomi touch on this very important issue in this case that I think is a threshold issue for this court, and that's the level of intent required. If we look at levels of intent on a spectrum, for example, the most possible intent that anyone could have is specific intent, where they intend the specific result of her actions. We're not arguing here that the state had to prove that he intended to cause bodily harm to RR. We are arguing, and we agree, that it's a general intent crime, which is a step below specific intent. What we're asking the court to do is to be very careful so as to not interpret this particular statute as less than general intent, as one of mere recklessness or negligence, without a finding that he had to intend to throw his phone at her. We go from a general intent crime, which this is under Fleck, we all agree, to one of negligence or one of recklessness. The court asked about direct evidence of Mr. Johnson's intent. And here, there simply can be none. Just like in other cases where the court has found that there is the direct intent or the direct evidence of intent must come from someone giving you a view inside their mind. This court, no one, the jury, can crawl into Mr. Johnson's mind in those moments to find direct evidence of his intent.
Well, counsel argues that the body-worn camera where his statement is recorded reflects his intent. Do you want to address that argument?
I do, Your Honor. The body-worn camera footage indeed shows that he intended to throw his phone. The footage further shows, he clarifies in his statement that he did not intend to hit her, or he did not intend to throw the phone at her. He says that he was frustrated, that he was exacerbated, and he threw his phone in frustration, but not intending to hit her.
That sounds like general intent.
It doesn't
sound like accident. It sounds like general intent.
Well, I'm not going all the way to accident, Your Honor. I'm saying that he intended to throw the phone. He didn't intend to throw it at her. And, you know, we're going around and around this. But if he doesn't intend to throw the phone at her, what level of intent does he have? And what comes forward from case law finding that that's that's enough. We go back to my example where someone...
At her is the specific intent.
No, respectfully, Your Honor, specific intent is intending the harm caused by his action versus general intent is intending the action that caused the harm.
Well, I think if you intended to throw your phone at someone, a fact finder could infer that you had the specific intent to cause harm. If you intended to throw your phone at their face in particular.
Right, Your Honor. And the court's last statement, intended to throw the phone at her face, is what we're saying needs to be proven here in order for him to be guilty of, well, domestic assault harm and also disorderly conduct. We would concede that there is a physical element to the disorderly conduct charge if the state had proved that he intended to throw the phone at her. I would also concede, Your Honor, and counsel talked about this, but I think it's a very tough argument for us to say that if he did indeed intend to throw his phone at her, that he did not expect or did not reasonably know that that could arouse alarm or anger in others. I think that if he did indeed intend to throw his phone at her, that he should have known that that would cause her to be alarmed, that would cause her to be angry, et cetera. I would have reject counsel's argument about the dishes and things like that. I don't think we want to criminalize, you know, being loud when you're doing the dishes and accidentally waking up a child. Your Honor's asked about rational inferences inconsistent with guilt. And I think that the court can look to the evidence as a totality and find that the rational inference, that there is a rational inference, although the jury clearly, by their verdict, inferred that he intended to throw the phone at her. There are other rational inferences inconsistent with guilt, such as that he threw the phone at the wall. He did not intend to throw the phone at her. And that can be inferred from earlier on in the argument, where he knocked other things off of his desk but did not throw anything at her. Like I said, when he apologized, the fact that he tried to disengage himself from the argument several times suggests that his intent in that moment was not to throw the phone at her. And then, Your Honor, the state's evidence also includes his statements on the body camera. I understand Your Honor wanted to, I think, made the good point that his testimony is not evidence that we should consider when looking at those rational inferences. But the state's evidence did include his statement on body camera, which specifically said he did not intend to hit her. And I'm out of time, Your Honors. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Appreciate your arguments today. We'll take the matter under advisement. It's been submitted, and we will issue. That concludes our oral calendar. We are going to retire to handle our final oral case on Zoom this morning. We'll stand in recess. Thank you.
All rise.